Blog Talk Radio.
Detrimental moniker. The original
original skinheads were all about unity and helping people out and, you know, watching out for each other, protecting your neighborhoods, that kind of thing. You know, it's not the skinhead movement that a lot of people associate it with. This is a song by Guns on the Run. This is called Return of the Skinhead. They're also a Philly-based band, by the way. Out of America. The Foreskins were a working class oi punk band out of the East End of London, England. They disbanded in 84. They formed in 79. Although a new lineup did form in 2007, but they aren't really the same band. The only one left, presently is Gary Hodges and Steve Hammer. Actually, yeah, Gary Hodges is the only one presently. Gary Hodges is a singer, and he's the only one presently still in the now touring band. But this is Four Skins with Clockwork Skinhead.
Oh,
really like their sound. There is some really horrendous news coming out of Washington, D.C. There's a nightclub there, DC9, that has hosted many, many, many punk bands and has really gone above and beyond in helping bands both starting out and touring through. Unfortunately, there was a beating death of a man outside the DC9 nightclub last week after an Agnostic Front show. According to the report by the Washington Post, five men were charged with aggravated assault Saturday in the beating of Ali Ahmed Mohammed. Mohammed had tried to enter DC9 but was refused at the door. He responded by throwing a brick through the club's front window, and five men left the bar and chased him. The worst part of this is one of the five was DC9's co-owner, William Spieler, and four employees. That's bad. They're going to get shut down, no doubt. They stomped the victim on the head and body is what's being reported. But either way, this poor young man did die. And, you know, I don't care how you feel one way or the other, but, you know, it certainly hurts the punk community at any point when, you know, a club closes down. But when you have actions such as this undertaken by an owner and, you know, really shit's going to happen. You own a club. People are going to be pissed off. They throw bricks through your front window. Great. You grab them and you hold them for the cops. But, you know, you don't kill somebody. So, you know, I really think DC9 is going to end up being closed down, which is really unfortunate. And, you know, and you should have known better. You know, shame on him, William. If it did, in fact, happen, I'm not saying it did or didn't. But shame on you if you did actually do that, you know, and you fucked a lot of people in the D.C. area. By thinking selfishly. We are going to play, the next song is a band that, this is actually one of my favorite songs by this band. They've been called a lot of things, post-hardcore, emotional, hardcore, all kinds of stuff. I just think they're fucking punk rock. I really like these guys. Some people don't like them. I really do. And there's talk of them reuniting. Actually, they are on tour right now with Bouncing Souls down in Australia, and I'm really hoping these guys are coming back here because I happen to like them a lot. And Chuck Reagan, we had on here a couple weeks back, is actually a very good friend of mine. I've known him for quite a long time, and I actually have the vinyl of this this record, Flight in a Crash. This is Paper Thin by Hot Water Music. We'll be right back. Okay, that was Howard Music with Paper Thin. I really like that song. And actually, Flight in the Crash is a great album, and you know, certainly from my point of view. And I'm hoping that those guys make it back through the U.S. to do a tour. And there's been a lot of talk of it. So hopefully that will happen. Up next, we have a band also from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I'm from Philly, so fuck you if you don't like it. They are a phenomenal street punk and boy band, the Boyles. They're also huge hockey fans. They're currently on TKO Records. You know, they consist of Greg Boyle, Eric Endicott, Christopher Endicott, and John Brennan on bass. And then they have Oscar Capps on guitar as well, although they've had several other members. Unfortunately, they did call it quits, which sucks for all of us. You know, in August they announced that they put the band to rest, and they're not going to play a final show. And it really sucks because these guys are fucking kick ass, and they are punk rock. So this is the Boyles. With Paper Dolls and on the whole paper genre. Okay, that was the Casualties with We Are All We Have. Next, we have a band that is actually a side project for one of the members of Travis Poe, who is in his main project is Death Crisis, and we interviewed those guys last week, and really the music didn't turn out all that well, and I apologize to those guys. And I tried to get a hold of one of their CDs, but they were sold out. This is a side project, though. This is a band called The Mice. You can check them out at micemusic.com, M-I-C-E, music.com. This is a self-produced CD by the band. This is Mice with Speak to Me.
Warbird Entertainment.
You can find them at warbirdentertainment.com. And they have some, well, Harvard. Harbor 81, and you, everybody should really check these guys out. If you go to warbirdentertainment.com and click on their music link, they'll have different songs by the different bands, and they really, really have some great bands out there. Tommy Gustin and the Idiots, you know, Guns on the Run, American Werewolves, and Harbor 81. Harbor 81 sounds a lot like 80s throwback punk. They're from Sweden. I'd also like to thank Conformity Clothing. That's Conformity with a K, conformityclothing.com. They got some really badass clothing you can check out. Conformity helps out a lot of punk bands that are touring by giving them swag to sell. You know, they don't have to, they do. They sponsor bands like The Addicts, you know, and bands like that. They also sponsor smaller touring bands like NFFU out of Boise, Idaho, and Never Say Never out of Salt Lake City. Very good street punk bands. And I would like to thank, well, shortly we'll be thanking John Pepsworth for coming on. I'd also like to thank DyingScene.com. DyingScene.com is a punk rock news station. Dying Scene is very well written and very well read as well. They really put it out there and pull no punches. They're not, you know, they're very honest with their assessments of, you know, what's going on. And, yeah, they're really a great website, DyingScene.com. Right now, we're going to get into a band off of the DC Jam record label. This is one of my favorite songs by Machine 22. This is Citizen Zero. Machine 22, and they are off of the DC Jam record label. And in talking to Darren from DC Jam, you know, I told him, I really think those guys are going to go somewhere, and I really hope they do because they're a damn good band. And I'm hoping they swing through Salt Lake at some point because I'd really like to get them, you know, see them on stage. Speaking of that, the Street Dogs are going to be coming through with Flatfoot 56, and they are presently on tour. And I'd really, well, I'm going to be going to see them. But right now, we're going to get into some commercials, and then we're going to come back, and we are going to get on the phone with John Pebsworth, who is a phenomenal musician, who you know has played in Buck 09 since almost its inception in '91, and we'll talk to him about that more. Right now, we're going to get into some commercials, though. And you are listening to San Clemente Punk on the Fighting Words Radio Network here on blogtalkradio.com. By the way, if you'd like to get a hold of us during the interview, you can call in and talk to John. It's 347-202-0832. Here's some commercials, fuckers.
Fighting Words Radio Network listeners, if you are into 80s metal, don't forget to check out All Hail Hair, the show that brings back the greatest era in music, the hair metal days. Join hosts Bob Carroll and Francis as they walk you down memory lane and transport you back to the late 80s when your biggest worries were gas money, homework, and trying to get a date for the weekend. All Hail Hair not only plays the staples from the hair metal days, but also bands like London Choir Boys, Kix, Crocus, Jet Boy, Pretty Boy Floyd, Shotgun Messiah, and others you may have heard but have forgotten. They will also keep you up to date on the status of your favorite 80s bands. All Hail Hair is not only the place that you will hear the latest from your favorite 80s bands like Poison, Def Leppard, Rat, Warrant, Winger, and Danger Danger, but also you will hear from current bands like Wigwam, Pretty Maid, Vane Vagina, and Hardcore Superstar that are keeping this sound alive today. So slip on the parachute pants, spray on the Aquanet, get into the leg-worn spandex, and tune in to the best 80s metal show, All Hail Hair. Friday night, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on the Fight Wars Radio Network.
How do you make a great water heater even better? That's easy. You take the brand most purchased by plumbing contractors, Bradford White, and add the awesome technology of the Icon Control System. The Icon System is an electronic gas control available only from Bradford White. When used with the exclusive Icon System accessory packages, increases usable hot water by up to 50% or more and can improve energy efficiency by up to 36%. In addition, there's leak protection, programmable control, and automatic water shutoff for peace of mind. To find a plumbing contractor and learn more about the Icon Control, visit BradfordWhite.com.
This portion of the program is presented by Dr. Kathleen Carroll of Bloomingdale Psychiatric Associates in Brandon, Florida, on behalf of the men and women in the armed forces, law enforcement, and fire rescue. Dr. Carroll treats psychiatric problems from the womb to the tomb, from children to adults. Her office is professionally staffed to deal with any type of problem and does so in a caring, gentle fashion. Dr. Carroll also specializes in sports psychiatry. If an athlete is not able to reach the next level, she can help. She is a world-class athlete, and her training in both sports psychiatry and sporting events will benefit today's athlete who has seemed to hit the wall. Dr. Carroll is located at 336 East Bloomingdale Avenue in Brandon, Florida. For more information on her services, give the office a call at 813-689-2466.
Okay, I really got to talk to Dr. Carroll about that music. It's disturbing, to say the least. Right now, I am going to get a hold of John Pebsworth. John Pebsworth is longtime frontman for the ska punk band Buck 09. Buck 09 has toured relentlessly and played nonstop since the band's inception in San Diego, California in 1991. Buck 09 has released 9+ albums, Not all have been released, actually, in the plus column. They've been included on many compilations, have been, you know, a fixture on the Vans Warped Tour, and released several singles. And we are lucky enough tonight to have John Pedworth with us. And we are going to try and get a hold of him right now. And, okay, the switchboard shut down for a second. But, okay, it's coming back up. You know, and I encourage anybody who wants to do a show to get on Blog Talk, but really there's some glitches in the system that really, you know, chat my balls at times. Okay, we're dialing now for John Pedworth. Let's see if we can hold up. Hello? Hi, John.
Yeah.
Hey, John, it's Frank from San Clemente Hip Hop. How are you today?
Good, bro. How you doing?
Good, good. And for everybody that's listening, John, we are joined now by John Pedworth, longtime frontman for Bucko 9. John, thanks for joining us here on San Clemente Punk on Funhorns Radio Network. How are you tonight?
I'm good, man. Just chilling. I'm actually sitting in my office right now.
Okay. We can get into that now. You work for Side One Dummy, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I've been here about 10 years now.
Oh, wow. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, now, so I'm getting to Bucko 9. You were not the original singer, correct?
Well, I started singing in the band about 19 years ago. And, yeah, they had a singer for a couple of months before me, but, you know, he never recorded anything, and they played, like, two shows or something like that.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I guess technically I'm not the original singer, but I'm the only singer that's, like, recorded albums and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. Now, how did you get the gig? How did they, you know, how did they find out about you?
I actually answered an ad in the local newspaper. They used to have a lot of, like, band ads and stuff in San Diego in this newspaper called The Reader. And it was just, like, classified ads, and they always had, like, musicians and stuff in there. And one day I came across an ad that just said, ska band looking for punk singer. And I was like, shit, dude, that's me. I got to call these guys. So I called them and basically, like, set up, you know, time for me to come down and check them out and like, kind of do an audition kind of thing. And, the rest is history.
Right, right. Now, there's a lot of different stories about, you know, how the band got its name. Care to clear that up for us?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why, probably because nobody actually remembers how the name came about. So that's why there's probably different, you know, stories out there. That's the real truth of it. Some guys are like, oh, yeah, we were, like, pitching in money for beer or for pizza or something, and that, like, no, you know, that's all we had. And other people, you know, seem to remember it being a reference to, like, somebody's weight, like, it was too skinny, you know, like, really skinny guy. Like, man, he doesn't weigh nothing but a buck 09, like, there's some old Eddie Murphy, I think,
right,
skit about that. So, yeah, and they had the name before I joined the band, so I wasn't there. But, when I first joined, I was like, yeah, it's a cool name. Let's keep it, you know.
Right.
But that's basically the best I can do on that one.
Okay. Now, John, prior to Bucko 9, you were not in a ska punk band. You were in a band called Label Victims, and this was a hardcore punk band. How did you move from hardcore punk to ska? Was this something that always kind of spoken to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I first started playing music as a singer, I didn't really play any instruments or anything like that, and, you know, I loved music, and I started playing in the hardcore, in the punk band, just because that was really the only thing I could do. You know, it didn't require a lot of, you know, musical kind of experience or background or knowledge. It just kind of was more about, you know, emotion and attitude. So that was a lot easier for me. That's how, that was kind of my segue into it, into music. But my actual first love of music was ska. Like when I was in like fifth or sixth grade, there was a kid that lived down the street. He was like an older kid, and he used to ride a Vespa and like wear all these crazy patches on the back of his jackets and stuff. And I always thought that guy was pretty cool. And I finally got up to, you know, nerve to ask him, like, what is all that stuff? What is all this stuff that you have? And he told me that he was into two-tone ska and that he was a Rude Boy. And I was just like, fuck, that's awesome. So I kind of got into ska first. And then I got into punk, you know, when I was probably in, like, seventh or eighth grade. And because, you know, back in those days, like, when Buck 09 first started, there was really no such thing as a ska band that did punk and ska in one band.
Right.
You know, like there was just, that just really wasn't really a genre of music really at the time. So that's why when I saw that ad and it said ska band looking for punk singer, I was like, that's fucking awesome, dude. I gotta join this band. That sounds so cool. So that's kind of how it worked for me.
Right. Now one of your first gigs one of your first gigs for Buck 09 was opening for a band that really fused punk and ska together, the Mighty Mighty Boston's. Mm-hmm. How was that opening up for those guys?
Well, you know, the bands at that time, you know, the Boston's were, you know, basically just playing, you know, local places in San Diego, you know, some like club size venues and stuff. And since we were like a local band, the promoter would put us on a lot of those shows, you know, back in those days with those early bands. And that's kind of how we kind of got our foothold into the whole thing, too, because we would go and play in other cities with them, and then they would play with us and so on. But, yeah, I mean, those first early shows, like doing plain open-ups with the Boston's, it was like, I think that the promoter was like, what kind of a band am I going to get to open up for this band? Because no one in the world sounds like this except for maybe a handful of other bands, and we just happened to be one of them, and we were local, so we got the gig just based on the fact that we play the same kind of music, sort of, you know.
Right. Now, your first band, Label Victims, you also shared with Pat Kim, who's a current bass player for Unwritten Law. Do you still keep in touch with Pat?
Yeah. Actually, I just talked to him the other day, and matter of fact, we even got we did a little Labeled Victims reunion show about a month or two ago for one of the kids that we went to high school with. It was his birthday party, and he was like, "Yeah, I want you guys to play." So we got band back together because now we all live up in LA again, where we grew up, you know.
Right.
So. So it was easy to do. We got together and we learned a bunch of our old songs. It was a trip because we hadn't played those songs in, you know, since we were in high school, which is a long time ago, you know.
Right. That would have been a trip. I wish I had known about it.
Yeah.
It was an underground show.
Yeah, it was a backyard party. And we played on the top of a skateboard ramp in this huge backyard. It was really cool.
It
was really cool.
Just like back in the day.
Totally, exactly. That's exactly what we did. And there was tons of people from high school there and stuff. It was big, like, you know, it was a big party. It was fun.
Right. Now, John, according to legend, when you were brought into Buck 09, they just started playing music and you cracked open your binder full of lyrics, and it seemed like your lyrics plugged in perfectly with the band's music. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, because you know, I think the music and the lyrics, yeah, they did mold together pretty well. On that first album that we did, a lot of those lyrics had been written before the band I even joined Buck 09. Like, some of them were just kind of like lyrics that I never really had, like, any music to, and they were just kind of like, you know, yeah, like you said, like in a folder. And I pulled out the ones that I thought would work, and I kind of rearranged them a little bit to fit the song that I chose for them and stuff. So yeah, I think it fit pretty good.
Do you write pretty much nonstop music?
No, I don't. Unfortunately, I wish I could, but I go through spurts. You know, like when I do I'll write a bunch of music and lyrics and stuff, and then I'll just kind of like just go into a total void where I don't write at all, you know. Like, I'm in one of those right now. Like, I haven't written a new song in probably like a year. Like, I have ideas and stuff, but since I work, you know, at the label, that's like really does take up the majority of my time. And sometimes when I'm home, I just don't, you know, I'm not inspired to do anything or whatever. I just like, I'll end up going out to the bars and just drinking and hanging out instead of staying at home and working on music, you know, which is would be more healthy for me, but I just don't have anything to write about right now.
Right. Now, you know, people that you know, John has a Facebook page, and he's been putting on, you've been going to quite a few shows lately. What's one of the best that you've gone to recently?
Well, let's see. Last show I went to was on Friday night. Oh, no, it's not true. I saw a show yesterday, actually. It was really good. It was in Hollywood, this place called the Piano Bar, and it was a band. They're called, and the lead singer guy, his name's Austin Hanks, and he's like a blues. He's basically a blues guy, and his band fucking just was killer. They're like basically like a blues, country blues kind of band, and that was amazing. That was probably the best live band I've seen in a long time.
Okay, right. Now, there's a story about your second actual rehearsal. You showed up with a shoulder injury, and I read an interview on it, and you said something about stage diving in a non-crowded show.
Yeah, that's, wow, where did you read that? That's crazy.
I do my research.
Yeah, you did. That's good research. Yeah, actually, it wasn't a shoulder injury, it was an elbow. But I broke my elbow at a Corrosion of Conformity show at this place in San Diego called Soma. And they still have the Soma Club, but it's a different location than it was back then. And, I was in the moment, and I did a stage dive. And there was a pretty decent crowd there. And I kind of, like, you know, landed on top, and a bunch of people were kind of holding me up, and there's people everywhere. It's just kind of a mess. And then I was like, somehow I was dropped by the people that were kind of holding me up. And then when I dropped, the way I landed, I like just smashed my elbow into like a million pieces, this little bone that's in my elbow. And so I got up, I ran out, found my buddies, and I'm like, dude, we're out of here. Let's go. We've got to get to the hospital right now. And those guys are like, what? What are you talking about? The band's still playing. Well, fuck that, dude. I just broke my elbow. Like, you need to get me to the hospital now. This shit hurts like fucking crazy. So the text, the next time I showed up for, you know, Bucko 9 rehearsal, they were like, what happened? And I was like, just doped out on Vicodin and like chain smoking and stuff. So, yeah, but that's funny that you found out about that. That was a long, long time ago.
Yeah. Now, Bucko 9 started in 1991 officially, but you did not release any music until 1992 when you released a cassette demo entitled Buck Naked. Mm-hmm. Why was that? Did you guys really want to get a sound together before you put anything out there?
And also, you know, it costs money to record music and stuff. Like, there wasn't the, like, home studio technology that they have today, you know, back then. I mean, you know, you really had to kind of, or at least we felt like, you know, it was important to go into an actual recording studio, even if it was kind of a, you know, shittier one. But we wanted to do it in a studio, so it took us some time to, you know, kind of come up with a couple of bucks so we could get in there and record those songs. And we were having trouble, like, when I first joined the band, too, there was, like, and I don't even remember the details because it was 20 years ago now, but the guitar player that they had at the time wasn't really working out. And I think that also put a delay on any type of recording plans, you know. So once we finally got the guitar player thing situated, then with Jonas being in the band, then we recorded.
Okay.
That was Buck Naked. But all those songs are on – except for, I think, one or two, all those songs from that tape are all on the first album, Songs in the Key of Reed.
Right, right. And you know, mentioning Jonas kind of segues into my next question. How did you guys choose Jonas?
Well, I mean, he was, you know, I mean, he was just clearly the best guy that that came down to audition for us, and he also had the best, like, just overall personality and vibe, you know, because, you know, sometimes when you're choosing band members, you know, you got to keep in mind not just their musical abilities, but their personalities as well, because, you know, there's a chance that you could be spending a lot of time with these people, so, you know, you don't want to get some cocky dickhead that, you know, is going to be an asshole, even though he's a killer guitar player, you know. I mean, I'd rather have a guy that's, like, pretty good and has a lot of, you know, soul and heart in his playing, but isn't maybe technically as savvy, but and he's not a dick, you know. I'd just rather have someone cool around. So,
right.
Jonas was, like, basically the best of both worlds. He had a good vibe, and he was a killer guitar player, so it just kind of fit.
Right. Now, it's kind of interesting to note that a lot of the tracks, guitar tracks on Buck Naked, were actually laid by Scott Kennersley, because you already had that together prior to Jonas joining.
That's right. Yeah, Scott did, yeah, probably, I don't know, it was so long ago, but that is true, yeah, definitely Scott, like, because Scott back then was kind of the primary songwriter as far as, like, bringing in the music, you know, and
right.
So, yeah, so he managed to, he was able to play those songs on guitar pretty easily, I think, and then Jonas came in and did, I don't know, maybe two or three songs on that eight-song demo. I don't know if it was eight songs or six. I can't remember now. But yeah, that's true. Exactly.
Okay. Now, Buck Naked was released on Working Class Records. That was your own record label, correct?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't a real record label. It was just so, like, you know, we just made it up, basically. Because it's not like we really did any, like, it's not like we created a business or anything like that. We just were like, well, let's just put something on there. And, you know what I mean? Like, back in those days, I guess, or when you're, you know, in that early stage, you know, you're just kind of like, well, let's just put something on there that's, like, signifies that it's ours or whatever. And so
right.
We decided to call it Working Class Records. And then we came up with a little logo and everything, and we just kind of put it on there. But, yeah, it really wasn't, like, a legit record company, you know. It's nothing like where I'm sitting right now, you know, Side One Dummy, nothing like that.
Right.
Plus, it was,
well,
just like,
you know, back then,
too.
Yeah, well, back then, I mean, it was a lot harder to, because like you said, these home studios didn't exist. You didn't have,
mm-hmm.
you know, the computer with all this stuff on it.
Yeah.
You know, so it was a lot more difficult.
Yeah, it was definitely difficult. I mean, we sold those. We just basically sold those at our shows, and then we would go around to the, like, local record stores in San Diego, and just kind of, like, put them on consignment, or maybe they would buy a couple for, you know, $2, and they'd sell them for $4 or something like that, or whatever. So they were just a means to get our tunes into people's ears, and then maybe hopefully just continue to try to grow the amount of people that would come out to the shows, you know.
Right. Now, John, I want to get into one of your songs right now. I want to play a track off of Songs in the Key of Free,
mm-hmm.
one that has been mistakenly credited at times to other bands. I hold this song very near and dear to my heart, as I am an Irishman, the Irish Drinking Song. Could you tell us a little about this song?
Scott, our old bass player, he wrote that song, and he's actually singing the lead vocal on it. And, I mean, it's a definitely, like, really fucking fun little song, and it's fun to play live, and people, you know, have a great time when we play it live. And now that Scott's not in the band anymore, I just sing it, you know, when we play it live, and whatchamacallit. And, yeah, like you said, I mean, most people nowadays think that it's Flog and Molly that originally did that song. But, no, it was actually Scott Kennerly that wrote that song. And it's funny because I work here at Side One Dummy with Flog and Molly, and, you know, they even hear that sometimes.
What's that?
People ask us to Flog and Molly, guys, because I work with Flog and Molly now here at Side One. And so they ask, they even tell me that sometimes, you know, they get people bringing us. Yeah,
really
totally.
Not.
So, anyways, yeah, that's the story of the Irish Drinking Song, basically.
Okay. We're going to get into this. This is Irish Drinking Song by Bucko Nine. The switchboard will play it.
Well, I tumbled and at 2 a.m. all drunk and full of smoke. My wife said I have had enough. That said I'm sick. Get out! So I stumbled down to Kelly's pub across the edge of town. And I told the boys my story and we had another round.
Those are all still on Tang. And he still sells those, so. And then the other albums, they're still on TBT, even though TBT, I don't know what happened to TBT, but something happened. And so I'm not sure what the deal is with those. So I don't know. Maybe someday I'll get those back, and maybe I can re-release them through here, or I don't know.
Do you still have a lot of vinyl?
Do I? Yeah, I've kept all the vinyl that, like, was really important to me, that I, you know, was really special and stuff. So, yeah, and it's a pretty decent amount, although I've seen guys that have record collections that are just so ridiculous that, you know, they take up entire houses.
Right. Yeah,
so,
I don't have that.
Like the guy from Tang, the guy who owns Tang Records, he's got the biggest record collection I've ever seen. It's crazy. I mean, he has, like, roomfuls of vinyl. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah. You Curtis Casella?
Yeah, Curtis. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Now, it was at this time that Bucko and I really started to develop quite a following. Many of your early shows were in the dungeon at Soma, and those of you who aren't familiar with the club, could you fill us in on that moniker? The dungeon.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
Could you kind of fill us in on this, you know, why it was called the dungeon?
Oh, the dungeon thing. Well, I mean, basically it was just called the dungeon because it was like underground, you know, it was like a basement. And, you know, in San Diego, even anywhere in California, really, not a lot of places that have basements like that. So they had this big warehouse that was upstairs that had, like, the big stage and the big room. And then you go down these stairs, and there's a, you know, little room down there, and it's kind of, like, it's kind of dingy and creepy, and the ceilings are kind of low. So it's kind of, like, you know, just like a little cave. So I think it was appropriately named the dungeon.
All right. Now, at this time, you know, Bucko 9 was garnering a lot of attention, and even prior to your 94 release in Songs of the Key of Bree, this propelled you to the main stage at Soma, because you guys had a following of about 900 to 1,000 fans per show. Was that a little overwhelming to go from, you know, from just being a small, you know, Bucko 9 to, holy crap, there's 1,000 people out there?
It was a little overwhelming. I mean, it didn't necessarily happen, like, overnight, you know what I mean? Those numbers
right.
would, you know, gradually grow over time. But, yeah, you know, I mean, I do remember kind of having that feeling where, you know, I remember headlining, it was the second location of Soma, which was the one that was kind of over by the, not the one that they have now, but the one before that. Anyways, but, yeah, I remember thinking, like, oh, shit, this place is sold out, we're headlining, and there's, like, 1,500 people, you know, out there, and I was like, oh, shit, this is crazy, you know. So, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, there have been moments along the way where it was, it took my breath away a couple times, you know, and really kind of gave me a pretty incredible rush, you know, like, because that type of thing is pretty crazy. I mean, that's why it's so hard after, you know, you wouldn't be able to do that kind of shit for years, and then, you know, as time goes by and, you know, things change and ticket sales go down and stuff, you know, it's harder. It's the memory of that feeling is always going to be there. But it's definitely, like, one of those things where, but you could, you know, probably wouldn't be able to manage to get up to that level ever again, you know, I mean, in reality. And, hey, if it ever did happen, that would be great. But I just think realistically it would probably be pretty tough to do. So, yeah, I hold on to those memories of that time pretty well.
Okay, now Songs in the Key of Bree came out, and within a week of the album's release, Bucko 9 actually embarked on an ill-fated tour with Gangster Fun and MU330. I can tell the story, but if you could kind of give us a general overview of what happened.
Well, I mean, the tour, yeah, it was our very first tour. We really hadn't, I mean, we'd been outside of San Diego a couple of times, but, you know, we're talking like we played in, like, Vegas and, you know, L.A. and, you know, Riverside, you know,
right.
County and stuff like that. You know, we never really – and we've been out to, like, Phoenix, Arizona. But, you know, those are, like, one-day trips where you just go out there, play, come back. You know, we've never been on an actual tour. So we kind of didn't really know what to expect, or and we didn't really even know how to do it. We just, you know, we kind of had all these dates, and, you know, we had a van, we had a trailer and stuff, and, you know, we just kind of like, I don't know if we thought that maybe everywhere in the country would be just like it was in San Diego. I mean, I think that there was a little bit of that being, you know, we were almost that naive to where we thought, yeah, man, it's going to be rad. We're going to go out there and tour, and there's going to be people we're going to get to play every night, and there's going to be people at every single show and shit. And, you know, of course, the very first show was in Tucson, Arizona, and there was, like, nobody there. Like maybe there was, like, 10 or 15 people there.
Oh, my.
So the tour kind of proceeded to be that way for the next 5 or 6 weeks or however long it was, and I just remember thinking, oh, shit, we got a lot of fucking work to do, man. I mean, this is not going to be easy because, like, the way we had built up San Diego was we played, you know, a bunch of different shows, and, you know, it took us quite a while to develop that kind of following and that kind of draw in San Diego, and I realized, shit, we have to do that in every single city in the entire country, you know? We can't just do it in one city, and it magically happens in all the other cities. So that was when it really became apparent that, like, wow, this shit ain't easy, you know? Like, we got a lot of fucking work to do. So that was the next, I don't know, however many years we, you know, did that. We just continued to tour, and we did exactly that. We went to every city, you know, multiple times and just tried to develop following there. And, you know, we got lucky and we had some radio airplay for a little while that helped out and stuff like that. We were able to get on bigger tours. But just, you know, that was the grind.
Right, right. Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, yeah, I'm going to form a band. But it's not easy. I mean, even if you have a local following, you know, it's tough.
Yeah. It is. It's very hard.
Now,
but, you know, but if you're into it and, you're, you know, that's what you want to do, then it's obtainable, you know. Maybe not on the
right.
on a grand scale, but, you know, I think most anyone that has, like, a little something going, they could probably, you know, with a ton of enthusiasm, they could manage to get a little something going that would be probably well worth it.
Right. Now, Songs in the Key of Brie was followed in 95 by Barfly, and Barfly... It's actually a song that appeared on Songs in the Key of Brie and then on Barfly. Was that,
yeah.
You know, did that just make sense where you guys like, you know, I really like this song and I want to entitle this next, you know, album?
Kind of. Like, well, Barfly, the album, is it's kind of a funny little collection because that was right when we hooked up with Curtis from Tang. And,
right.
At the time, when he first saw us and we started talking about doing a record together, we didn't really have a lot of songs written that where we thought, like, yeah, we got, because most bands, you know, you write 15 songs and then you go in the studio and you record all 15, and, you know, you end up putting 12 or 13 of them on the record or whatever it is, you know. But we had, like, 4 songs written, I think, at the time. And we weren't even planning on putting out a record. We were just like, no, we're just going to tour and tour and tour, and we'll figure out, maybe we'll do a record at some other time. But Curtis was like, well, hey, man, I saw, you know, like in your show that I saw the other night, you know, you guys did some great covers. You know, you guys, we did like a Misfit song, Operation Ivy song, and some shit like that. And he was like, why don't we take the 4 songs you guys have and record some of those covers you guys do, and maybe put my favorite song from your last album, Barfly, on an album, and we'll have enough songs for an album, you know? And we were like, all right, fuck it, let's do it. So that's basically what, like, Barfly is almost like a compilation of, you know, different things, you know? So
right.
It was, that's kind of how it came to be. But Barfly was basically a put, I mean, Curtis just, he loved that song. It was his idea. And we were like, yeah, that's cool. I mean, you know, seems kind of weird maybe to put the same song on 2 different albums, but, you know, whatever. I mean, we figured,
right.
Fuck, it's punk rock. Who cares? You know what I mean? Whatever.
Exactly. No, I agree. Punk's always been like that, you know?
Yeah.
Now,
I mean, listen, people ask me about it all the time, and, you know, I just don't even remember why, but I remember thinking it wasn't a bad idea. You know, I was just like, yeah, it's cool, because if it was a bad idea, we probably wouldn't have done it, but I don't really know exactly why, with the exception of the Curtis part of it, you know.
Right. Now, John, sales for Barfly increased rapidly. At this time, however, Buck and I were slapped with a cease and desist order. What was that all about?
Well, the original album cover had a cartoon drawing of all of us sitting in a bar drinking, and we kind of made references to this movie called Barfly, which was
right.
A movie that our friend Curtis, he's the one who he turned us on to it, because we had the song Barfly, and he said, oh, have you ever seen the movie Barfly? And we're like, nah, never even heard of it. And he's like, fuck you guys. You guys are coming over to my house. We're going to drink a bunch of beers, and we're going to watch this movie together. And so we did, and that's kind of like we bonded on the whole Barfly thing. But and so basically the cease and desist letter, what happened because we took little paper cutouts of the two actors that were the stars of the movie, Barfly, Mickey Rourke and Faye Dunaway.
Right.
So we actually had, like, from the little, like, VHS box, we cut out their faces from it and put it on our album cover. And so we got a cease and desist letter from Faye Dunaway's, I don't know, publicist or, whoever it was, movie company maybe. So, yeah, that was kind of weird. So then we ended up with a second cover on the second pressing that was just a little, with a fly sitting at a bar drinking a beer by himself.
Right, and that was designed and drawn by Steve Bauer, correct?
Correct, yep.
Okay, yeah. Now, John, I want to play a song off of Barfly. This is entitled Water in My Head. Could you give us a little background on it before I play it?
Yeah, Water in My Head. It's kind of a, I don't know. Water in My Head. It's just kind of like a song about being confused, you know, and it seems like that seemed to be a kind of typical topic of lyrics for me at the time, you know, that, like, you know, makes references to drinking and kind of just being, you know, a little bit, you know, kind of like that punk rock thing when you're a kid and you're just kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing, where I'm going. I don't know what's, I feel like I got water in my head. I'm like cloudy. I'm confused, you know, so. That's basically the gist of it. It's hard to say because, you know, like, I'll quote Bob Dylan when he gets asked about lyrics that he wrote back in the, you know, 60s and stuff. He's like, man, I don't know. I was a different person back then. I don't know what I was thinking, you know. He would say that a lot about his songs. So, you know, in a way that I could relate to that because I just, you know, when I wrote Water in My Head, it's kind of like, shit, I don't even know, like, where I was at as a person. I mean, I can kind of remember, but... you know, like what kind of thoughts were going in my head and, you know, in and out and where I come up with these little phrases, I have no idea.
All right. This is Bucko 9 with Water in My Head.
I'm sorry.
Okay, that was Water in My Head by Bucko 9. Welcome back to San Clemente Punks here on the Fighting Words Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. If you'd like to contact me directly, you can send emails to sanclementepunk, all one word, at yahoo.com, or search San Clemente Punk on Facebook. Tonight we are joined by John Petworth, frontman for Bucko 9. To take part in tonight's show, you can either use the free Skype link on the show's page or call us at 347-202-0832. John, again, thanks for coming on. John, I actually have a caller on the line that would like to talk to you. This is Robert out of Florida, if you don't mind me bringing him on.
No, that's cool.
Robert, thanks for joining us tonight on San Clemente Punk. You have a question
for John? Yeah, thanks, Dad. First of all, thanks for having me on. And John, I've been a longtime fan of Bucko 9. I'm really happy to see that you guys are still around and still making some great music.
Cool, man. Well, thanks.
Absolutely. I heard you talking about the movie Barfly, and I have to say you forgot one of the main characters there. Of course, Frankie Stallone, who played the bartender there.
That's right.
That was my favorite guy in that.
He's great.
It was, and like you said, that was a great movie, and it's a shame that Faye Dunaway, I mean, as much publicity as she really isn't getting, it's a shame that she had to do that, to put a cease and desist order out on you guys. That's a funny story, though. Get you guys a little bit more publicity, too.
Yeah, a little bit. We actually considered taking the letter and putting the letter on the album cover, the re-release, but we thought, we probably shouldn't do that.
You know, then she would have sued you, and then you would have gotten even more publicity out of it.
Yeah, probably.
But I kind of just joined the show late, and one of my favorite songs for you guys is Irish Drinking Song, and I'm not sure if you guys have played that yet.
Yeah, he played it already.
Yeah.
Okay,
he played it.
What's the background to that? Covering that.
Well, like I was saying earlier. Basically, Scott, our original bass player, he wrote that song, and he just wanted to have like a fun, drinking kind of song, and he just thought, it's hard for me to say what he was thinking because, I don't have ESP, but I think, it was just like something fun that he had written, and everybody really liked it, so that's basically
gotcha.
It, and he's the one singing on that, too, on the record,
Gotcha. Well, I didn't really have too much more. I just wanted to kind of joke with you about the movie Barfly and Frankie Stallone there. And I really appreciate you guys still being around and putting in some good music.
Okay, dude. Well, thanks, man.
All right. Talk to you later.
Cool.
Thanks, Robert. Later, okay, John, now, after Barfly, 28 Teeth came out, and it saw a spike in Bucko 9's popularity with your radio play increasing with My Town. And My Town had quite a bit of radio success and play on MTV, leading to sales of over 200,000 copies. What was the feeling in the band when that happened?
Obviously it was really super, super exciting. It was like, wow, we're, this is getting crazy now. But, I think we also felt a really big, huge sense of accomplishment, too, because going back to that very first tour and drawing, 1,500 people in our hometown of San Diego, but drawing 15 people in everywhere else, in every other market, that was really disappointing and how we realized, wow, it's going to take a lot of work. And I think when we jumped into that zone where we did go past 200,000 copies of that record and stuff, we started to see that we are drawing 1,500 people in other cities now. And that, I think, was big, felt really good because we've worked so hard and we've spent so many months and years on the road and just working and working and working. And, we felt like, hey, we accomplished our goal. This is pretty cool. So I think as people, it was kind of around that time in all of our lives, I think that this band really kind of like, defined us and, because when you have a dream and you have a goal and then you actually like achieve it and you live it, then I think that, has a pretty big impact on people's lives. You know, I mean, it's certainly something that I'll never forget, and it was really, really cool.
Right. Now, at this time, you guys continued a great relationship you had with the Suicide Machines. How did that relationship come about, first off? And is that something that, although they broke up, Kate, you know, they just played July 24th, they reformed and played a special show, but, you know, I'd love to see those guys come back. But is that a was that a relationship you enjoyed throughout their career?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it was those guys, we met them in Detroit. We were playing at this place called the Falcon Club, and we just were on the show. It was it wasn't like really a tour that where the bands were following each other. We were on like a point of our touring cycles that we would just like, we just hop on different little shows all over, you know, in different cities, and just the guy that would book our shows just would find these fucking crazy shows all over the place, and we'd just be driving our van all around. And so we played that show at the Falcon Club in Detroit, and the Suicide Machines were one of the bands that was playing also that night, and we just met them. That's what we met them then. And I don't know, like, and then we just kind of became buddies, and I can't remember all the details, but, you know, and then I think at some point we got, the guy who books us started booking them, and then he said, hey, why don't you guys do a tour together? I'll set it up, and we were like, both bands were like, yeah, cool, and that's when we really became buddies because we did the whole tour together. Yeah. So yeah, and you know, they're I just talked to Jay not that long ago, and because they put out two records here on Side One, so I got to work with them on their, post major label albums, which are really good, by the way.
Yeah, War Profiteering was a phenomenal album. I really liked that.
It was.
I've been looking. Did that come out on vinyl? Because I've been looking everywhere for that thing on vinyl.
Which one? War Profiteering? Yeah.
It's
we have that on vinyl. Yeah. Email me your address. I'll send you a copy.
Oh, great. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Now, 28 Teeth was followed by Libido in 99. At this time, the release saw the departure of Steve Bauer. Was this a good split, or was it, you know, how did that come about?
Oh yeah, it was a good split. I mean, you know, I was bummed that he left because he's one of my best friends. He's still one of my best friends to this day. But you know, he had gotten to a point in his life where he wanted to he just didn't want to tour anymore like the way we were touring because you know we were on the road so much, and him and his girlfriend they had just gotten engaged, and I think that he was ready to kind of like change his lifestyle and be married and be a little bit more. I guess settled down, you know, would be the best way to put it. So he let us know. He's all, hey, I'm not going to leave until all the tours are done. And you know, he stayed after the time that he quit, or however you want to put it. He was still in the band for like probably 4 or 5 months, you know, and we're just waiting out all of our touring commitments. And so once those were done, he helped us find another drummer and everything. So yeah, it was totally amicable and friendly and everything. You know, I mean, it was sad to see him go. I didn't want him to leave, you know, but you know, that kind of, you know, people have lives they have to lead, you know, the way they want to. So.
Right. Now, John, we had spoken about this before, but Buck and I brought in a session drummer, a very good friend of mine and the show, Chuck Therese.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find Chuck? How did you settle on Chuck? Who, by the way, everybody's heard Chuck Therese. People may not know it, but they've heard him. The guy's played in so many different bands. Phenomenal.
Totally. Yeah. No, he's a fucking rad guy. Well, at the time, what happened was the drummer that we kind of decided to go with after Steve left, he kind of started getting a little weird and, you know, it just wasn't working out with this dude, and we were already like in the process of like writing and getting ready to record our next album, the Libido album, and so things got all crazy, and we were just like, oh shit, and so we had to let this drummer go because it just wasn't working out, like personality wise, nor musically, it wasn't working out either, And so we were a you know, seven piece ska punk band without a drummer. So it was a total bum out. But the guy that ended up producing our record, this guy Stiff Johnson, he was like, hey man, I know the fucking perfect guy, because he was from Philadelphia. This guy Stiff, and
right.
He's like, I know the perfect guy. They could come in here. We'll fly him out from Philly, and you know, and he can just nail this shit, no problem. And so we were like, all right, who is he? And he's like, this guy, his name's Chuck Treese. And we're like, cool, we know who he is, and done. Like, so he, sure enough, he came out. We rehearsed with him for probably 3 or 4 days, and then went straight into the studio. He did all the drum tracks in like a day or two, and then he was back on a plane to fucking Philly, and so now we're friends on Facebook.
Chuck's a great guy. I remember going to shows, these basement shows with Chuck, and you know, we'd watch the show, and then when the band's like, we're taking a little break, Chuck would ask him if he could play their you know, hey, can I, you know, play your guitar or your drums, or, and you know, they think they're a badass, so, like, you know, go ahead. And Chuck would just blow everybody away. And more people ended up watching Chuck than watching the band.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, Chuck's a great guy. Now, the release of Libido saw the track Who Are They was played on 6 Foot Under. You guys were meeting with more and more success. Was it overwhelming to, you know, to turn on the TV, like 90210 played My Town, and then 6 Foot Under played, you know, Who Are They? Was that a little overwhelming? Were you guys like, whoa, what the hell's going on here?
A little bit. I mean, the TV shows and the movies and stuff like that, that shit was pretty trippy, you know. But it wasn't like, it didn't scare me or freak me out or anything. I was just like, yeah, cool, you know, let's do some more of that shit. Only thing I will say though about the song that was in 6 Feet Under was that that's like one of my all time favorite shows in the whole world, and I was so excited that the song was gonna be on there. But they don't really tell you, you know, the premise of the scene or any of this kind of shit, right? But scene that they used our song in was you know how on that show, if you're not familiar, it's like that show opens up with somebody dying. You know, that's the opening scene for every episode. So this particular episode, they used our song in the opening scene, and it was a scene where these gangster dudes roll up in a car at an ATM machine like somewhere in West Hollywood, and there's a guy, you know, getting money out of the ATM machine, and they basically mug him and like, you know, gay bash him and, you know, beat the crap out of him. And the guys in the car, the gangster guys, are listening to Who Are They in their car, you know? So it's kind of a bummer because I'm like, oh, great. So the gay bashers are listening to our band. That's really nice. I was a little disappointed in that. But other than that, you know, it was still pretty exciting to have the music in there, you know? And the 90210 thing was cool. That guy... Brandon Walsh or whatever his name is in real life, I forget. He actually came to one of our shows in Hollywood. It was really, that was weird. And he's like, hi, you know, my name's Jason Priest. That's it. And he's like, yeah, I really like you guys' music and stuff. And we're like, oh, cool. You know, it's kind of weird, but yeah. So I guess shit like that is kind of trippy. But it's exciting though. It's like, you know, fun.
Yeah. Now the 6 Foot Under was that when you guys decided to become a gangster ska band?
That was the first gangster ska band.
Gangster ska. John, I want to play off the 2018 the song My Town. Could you give us a brief background on the song?
On My Town, it's basically a song about, you know, being homesick, I think is the best way to put it. You know, like I have been saying throughout this conversation is, you know, we were on the road a lot, and, you know, we lived in San Diego and stuff, and, you know, being gone, you kind of miss home, and so I kind of wrote a song about living, you know, about my home, you know, and... But I know that a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, it's a song about San Diego. And, you know, it is, but it's really a song about it for anybody. You know, you could be – and it's not a – you know, it's not a hometown chant. It's more of a nostalgia, like it's a I miss being home, you know, kind of like – it's a song to try to cheer you up when you miss home, I guess. That's kind of how I felt about it.
Okay. Well, this is Buck 09 with My Town.
And
I think that was kind of the beginning of the end of our touring career. The first thing that it affected was the fact that we couldn't finish the tour, and we were all the way across the country in Pittsburgh, you know, and we're from San Diego, and we had about 11 or 12 shows, I think, left on that tour, you know, and so instead of, you know, completing those shows, which we'd never really missed a show ever until those shows, and so what we ended up staying in Pittsburgh for a couple of days while he was in the hospital, and then eventually his family, like his mom and his dad and his sister, flew out there, and they kind of like took over, you know, taking care of him and stuff, and then so we had to jump in the van and bounce back to San Diego, and we thought maybe we might be able to still catch our very last show of the tour, which was going to be our hometown show. So we made it back, and we called an old friend of ours, this guy that plays bass that we know, and he's a cool guy. And we called him and said, hey, we're going to be back in San Diego in like a week. We've got this show. Is there any way you could play? Can you learn the songs? You know, while we're driving, you learn the songs, and we'll get there. We'll see you on stage. Is that cool? And he was like, yeah, totally. I'll totally do it. So that's Andy Platfoot, who's the current bass player of the band. So basically after John Bell got better and he came home, I can't remember exactly how it went down, if we played some more shows with him or not, but he ended up leaving the band for various reasons, whatever. And that's when we got Andy full time. So Andy's been in the band now for, I don't know, probably like 8 years or something like that, or 7 or 8 years probably.
Okay.
So everybody else.
Right. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Now, in 2000, Bucko and I recorded a live album, Hellos and Goodbyes, which included unreleased tracks as well, but you decided not to release it. Why was that?
Mm-hmm. Why the unreleased songs, you mean?
No, why did you choose not to release that live album?
Well, we did kind of release it, even though it was, like, released on, you know, like, our own label again. It wasn't the original one that we put the cassette out on, but I had actually started this very small record label back then, and had another band on it and stuff, and then the live album is on that label, even though it was really super small, so it didn't really get a lot of, I wasn't able to give it too much of a push, you know?
Right.
But it did come out, and those songs, those were like demos that we had done for what was going to be potentially a follow-up to Libido.
Okay.
But never came to fruition. So.
Okay. Now, at this time, you know, in 2001, Bucko 9 faced the waning enthusiasm of ska, and it was a lull that followed within the band as well. How close was the band to dissolution at this time?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, I think also that drive home from Pittsburgh, like, that was, you know, that type of feeling was really setting in pretty hardcore at that point. And then we just lost a bunch of money because we didn't play 11 shows. And, you know, the whole ska punk thing felt, you know, like it was really coming to a close and everyone's bummed out. And, you know, ticket sales are down and record sales are down and, you know, there's new things going on, and, you know, it was a really bad time, and, we finally, everyone was just kind of like, you know, fuck this, and, so just kind of, I don't know, it just kind of fell apart, and I think we finally decided, like, yeah, we just can't afford to tour anymore. I mean, that's basically the reason why we stopped doing it, was it just didn't make financial sense anymore. Like, you can't sell enough tickets to put gas in the van and can't make the van payment, and we can't afford hotels or anything else. So if you can't do any of that stuff, then you can't tour anymore, you know?
Right. Right. Now, John, you know, we're kind of, I hate the fact that we're coming up towards the end of the show, but, I got a ton more questions I wanted to ask you, but, John, you've been in the music business a long time. You've seen bands come and go. That's fine. Who are some of the acts
or people right now that are really causing you to sit up and take notice?
I'd have to say the Gaslight Anthem is one that I think is they're very, you know, influential and important band of this, like, 2010 or, you know, 2008 to 2010 period, and they're going to continue to be a really special band, I think, for this time. I dig them. They're on Side 1 Dummy, of course, but it's not like a sales plug. I'm just saying, you know, we only work with bands we love anyways here, so, you know, we all love them and just think a lot, you know, very highly of the band. So, I'd have to say right now, I mean, they're a band that really excites me. There's not a lot of other ones out there I can honestly say that I'm thrilled about, like, as far as, like, new bands. I like some of the older bands that have put out new records, like their new records and stuff, but I don't know. It's hard for me to say, like, there's some cool shit out there, but, you know, it's kind of a weird time, I think, right now with music and stuff. I'm not vampire core guy, you know, like their bands with their hair and that kind of stuff just doesn't really interest me because it just seems like more of a gimmick than an image thing than it is a actual music thing. And, you know, it's just kind of, I'm not feeling it really.
Yeah. Well, Danzig did that in 78. So, you know, it's not like it hasn't been done before. So,
yeah.
Now,
and Danzig also had great, like, the Misfits had great songs. Those are well-written fucking great songs. These guys don't have any songs at all. Their songs, it's just, there's no music to back any of that shit up, you know, so.
Right.
Kind of a drag.
Right. Now, John, are we going to see Buckle 9 on the road anytime soon?
Probably not. I would doubt that would happen. I wouldn't say never because, you know, that would be silly. But for now, I think that, you know, like, most of the guys in the band are married and have kids, you know, and have their families and, you know, their priorities are different. So I don't know, you know, we'll see. I mean, I'm open to anything, you know, like, if it seems like it could work, you know, and, cause I mean, I love to play. We're playing a show next month in San Diego.
Okay.
Not really a road, not on the road, but yeah, we are playing November, 6th at the Casbah in San Diego. Kind of, I guess it'd be kind of like our 19-year anniversary show.
Okay.
So.
Now, John.
That's the only show we have planned.
Okay. John, again, thank you so much for joining us tonight on San Clemente Punk. We've got about five minutes left, and I want to play a song to end the show. But I want to give you the final few minutes to give any shout-outs or catch us up on where we can find John Pepsworth and Buckle 9 online. The floor is yours, John.
Well, obviously the normal places, you know, we have a website. It's just buckle9.com, and I don't know how often we update it anymore, but probably not very often. We have a MySpace. It's just, you know, the usual Buckle 9, and then I don't know if you even have a Facebook or not. I should look into that. And then our sax player, Craig, he runs a Buckle 9 Twitter, but I don't know how. He doesn't tweet like these bands today, like, you know, tweeting, you know, what they had for lunch, you know. I think it's usually just like whenever we have a show or some sort of event or something that's going on, he'll hit a couple tweets out. But, yeah, that's about it. And then, you know, obviously come and check out all the Side 1 Dummy bands. That's just side1dummy.com. That's, you know, I'm working on all those bands and stuff. So, yeah, I'm on Facebook and all that shit. So, thanks for having me, man. It's actually, you got me right up to the end of my work day here. So I got to close out a couple things, and then I'm going to go home and drink some beers.
All right. Sounds good. Well, John, again, thank you so much for coming on, and we look forward to many more years of Buckle 9.
Cool.
And I'm going to finish the show with the song I'm Not Dead, which is very fitting.
Nice.
Could you give us a brief exposition on you know, kind of brief explanation on the song?
Actually that song, you know, it's probably has a different the story behind that is much different than I think most people would think, but that's actually a song about living in Hollywood.
and how there's, you know, there it just you just kind of meet these people that are just, I don't know, just kind of weird, just kind of different, you know, and not that bad or good, but, you know, and it's just kind of like people that maybe just would just completely ignore you, and, you know, like, I'll be like, hey, what's up, man, how's it going, and, you know, just like fucking like a ghost or something. So, yeah, it's kind of like, it's about, basically about living in Hollywood.
Okay. Well, John, again, thank you very much. I'm going to end the show now.
Yeah.
This is Buck09 with I'm Not Dead.
Cool. Thanks, brother.